The GP Plus Careers Podcast.
Are you a GP hoping to diversify your career? Perhaps you've got a passion for women's health or have ambitions to be an expedition GP. Or maybe you've just always wondered, what would it be like to be a GP working in a prison? Well, this will hopefully be the podcast for you. My name's Sophie Lumley. I'm a First 5 GP in the West Midlands and also a training programme director. I certainly fell into the above category, and I was keen to start this podcast to find out about the breadth of career options available to me, my colleagues and my trainees. I've been lucky enough to interview fellow GPs who've had some of these extra roles. They've told me what their role involves, how they got there, and the tips and advice that they have for those hoping to follow in their footsteps. I really hope you enjoy listening and feel as inspired as I have in speaking to them. I'm really pleased today to be joined by Hareen De Silva, who is a GP with an interest in humanitarian and global health. So without wanting to steal any of his thunder, over to you, Hareen. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do?
I'm a general practitioner, qualified in 2015, and then over time I've worked in expeditions and then moved into humanitarian work. And currently I'm the head of the health department for a humanitarian aid organisation called CADIS, based in Germany. So I'm actually dialing in from Berlin at the moment, where I split my time between Berlin and London to mix my general practice work and my Berlin headquarters job.
Wow. Okay. So that's exciting. You're our first sort of international podcast interview to join us today. Could you tell us a little bit about the sort of humanitarian work that you've done previously? Because obviously you're now got a sort of management role in the organisation. Can you tell us a little bit about what humanitarian work you've been involved in? I know you've worked in refugee camps before and things like that.
Yeah, so I've been doing this for approximately 5 years now. Started off, which in most places, which a lot of people do, is volunteering. So not jumping into a paid job first. And I did that with a small German organization called Medical Volunteers International in Greece, in on the Lesvos Island, the refugee camp there. And then ended up finding a job, which I had Googled, looking at going abroad again as a doctor, and I settled on an organization called CADIS, and I was there with them on and off for about 2 years in Syria and Iraq, initially as a doctor for 4 months in the world's most dangerous refugee camp in northeast Syria, Al-Hol refugee camp, and then came back a year later to become their medical coordinator, which is a management role, and then ended up back with them in Ukraine for a few months doing some education and medevacs, and then twice to Gaza in 2024, once as head of mission, so team lead for 3 weeks in Gaza, and then back with UK Med as their type 1 field hospital manager, which is essentially a fancy term for managing primary healthcare services. That was in August, September. And then, 1st of October, I started this role in Berlin, so split my time between Berlin and London, so mixing that in with my normal day-to-day general practice stuff.
Wow, you've done a lot of different things there. Can I take you back to the beginning, that first role you had in Greece, volunteering? What was it like doing that work?
So really difficult, actually. You're outside of your norm. I was actually turned out to be the most senior clinician on the ground. So I had foundation doctors from the UK and equivalent in Germany underneath sort of my scope of supervision, with some medical students and the nurses, etc. So it was really difficult initially to start with, but it was really good work. Lack of resources. It was during the COVID pandemic, so resources were very few and far between. The day would start, we would be there at 8:39, and then we would have 100 people lined up to get hold of primary healthcare services. We only had 100 appointments, so we don't have an appointment system. It's first come, first serve. Maximum 100 tickets are given out, and there would be more than 100 people there. So you're triaging through the crowd, etc., and trying to figure out who can get the appointments, which is it's a great introduction into what a lot of general practitioners do in the UK now, is going through that list of hundreds of phone calls and trying to triage the appointments to see who gets those appointments. So, and then just working with a lack of equipment and resources and medications and trying to manage primary chronic healthcare conditions the best you can with limited information and limited testing. So making decisions such as not starting ramipril, but going for amlodipine or phenlodipine because you don't need to monitor that for renal function, et cetera. And these sort of little things that you would only get as a general practitioner. Not to knock our hospital colleagues, but we're able to think outside of the box, and adapt our practice and not follow SOPs and protocols to the letter.
And you mentioned there, sorry, clearly some non-communicable diseases that you were managing. Was that what made up the sort of bulk of those 100 appointments that you were having? What sort of case mix did you have compared to what you were used to in UK general practice?
I'm very privileged and lucky to be a UK qualified general practitioner because a lot of it was dermatology cases. So you're having tents and accommodation, which are so close together, a lack of wash facilities. So the hygiene aspect of not being able to shower more than twice a week because there was a card system. So scabies, dermatitis, cellulitis. Just loads of those cases. Then obviously the mental health issues with people crossing the Mediterranean, and fearing and fleeing what they've done in their home country. So people across the whole of the Middle East, the African continent, and Asia as well. Mental health, dermatology, and then the worsening chronic non-communicable diseases such as hypertension, cardiac issues, where people have lost their medication on transit, don't have access to any of their health records, obviously. So then you're starting from scratch and then trying to incorporate that into the Lesvos health system, where you can't overrun the system in Lesvos. Because it's a finite resource, a very small district hospital. So you're trying to figure out who you refer on in negotiation with the public health department of Lesvos is there. So it's a lot of what we would see, but I think at the worst end of untreated diseases and quite a lot of significant mental health as well.
How did that differ, that experience in Greece, to working in what you said, that one of the most dangerous refugee camps in the world, and other places that you've worked? Was it a similar sort of system and a similar sort of case mix, or were there other sort of scenarios that were very different humanitarian kind of work?
So yeah, that job in Syria, whereas I was there as a clinical doctor, was very interesting how I got that. I was not the hospital internal medicine specialist they were looking for, but because of COVID, they weren't able to fill that gap. So they settled on me as a general practitioner. My ego wasn't affected, so I was fine with that, having the opportunity and privilege to work there. But it was a 24-bed inpatient facility which ran 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So because of safety, the international workers would, which was just me, the head of mission, and the logistician, would only be there during daylight hours. We would leave. So part of what I did was capacity building, education, trying to pick up topics that the local health staff thought they needed introduction or re-evaluating on, and just teaching there and doing a ward round in the morning. So it was going back to hospital work, so the ward round being available, and then just trying to work within my scope of practice and not working beyond my scope of practice, which is a very important trait when you're thinking about stepping into the humanitarian world, is not going off and thinking that you can practice skills abroad. Because one of the things I always teach is getting rid of that colonial mindset and doing what's best for the beneficiaries and integrating yourself locally into the healthcare system is very important.
So just thinking about that particular point about sort of not going beyond your skill set, how do you manage that? Are there any particular things you've been asked to do or sort of insinuated that you might want to do when you're in these scenarios that you felt was inappropriate, and how did you manage that?
So the good thing, I've been lucky to work with Caris and UK Med, where they are very strict in their code of conduct policy and saying you will not work beyond what you're able to do in your home country. So I've worked with doctors from essentially all over the world, and it's just working within that scope of practice. How my mindset is, would I do this abroad, or will I do it in the UK? Would I risk my GMC number or for nurses the PIN, etc., by doing something I would never do in the UK? So that's part of it. That's part of the law aspect, but the ethical issue as well. You have to have a very strong ethical moral compass, which keeps you in track when you're doing that. It's very easy to think you can get away with a lot of things, and I've seen it happen with other people I've come across in the humanitarian field. You're always going to come across it. It's standing up for what you feel is right, and that's really important. We do that in the UK with how we practice medicine, and there is no reason why we should not do that when we have deployed abroad.
Very clear there. I think that's really helpful, moral compass and points for people to think about before they put themselves forward for these sort of rules. So on to what you do at the moment. You've mentioned Caddis UK Med. Can you tell us a bit about who they are and what you do for them now?
UK Med was an organization I deployed for 6 to 8 weeks at the end of 2024 as the primary healthcare manager, essentially. So I just managed the day-to-day operations of the primary healthcare center. We were seeing 400 patients a day. So I managed 4 doctors, approximately 20 nurses, a physiotherapist, a security staff, and a cleaning staff, etc. So almost up to 50 people. I was supervising and just making sure the hospital ran to plan with the fuel for the generators, making sure the standards, the SOPs were in place, and writing new SOPs when we thought they were needed. And that was a great experience. I highly recommend UK Med as organizations any healthcare professional look at. So that was really interesting. Caddis, that was head of mission at the start of 2024. So that was team lead. So that was being involved in security, logistics, looking after the team. So I was managing a team of 13 persons in Gaza for 3 weeks, which was a huge responsibility if you think about sort of the context we were in February, March. So that was really interesting, very humbling as well to see life at its worst, injuries, etc. And now I've taken up a managerial position, so I'm in charge of setting standards, interviewing for new staff, and making sure that our direction of the health department, the medical department, is going in the place that we want to, based on our vision and our mission statement, which is not what you would expect it to be for me as a general practitioner, which is medevac, so medical evacuations and trauma stabilization. But it's as what we do in general practice. We find if we are not able to do what we think we can do, we find the appropriate person, whether that's appropriate referring or passing the patient off to our practice nurses or physios, etc. So it's just about finding the right person to do the right job at the time. So yeah, that's what I do at the moment. So that's a job that I do here in Berlin. Then obviously to maintain my performance list place, I come back every few weeks or so to do a few sessions in as a locum GP in London.
So you've got it sounds like you've got a nice sort of balance there between sort of UK and abroad work and also using your skills in the managerial side of things as well. You've clearly had a really interesting career journey into taking that managerial role and worked in several different humanitarian care situations. You mentioned the first one was as a volunteer. What triggered you to get involved in that? Had you done things that were related to that prior? And how's your career journey worked to date?
I started working a lot in health inequalities in Doncaster, Yorkshire. Was part of a team that helped set up a drop-in service for rough sleepers in the town centre. And I've always been interested in working in health inequalities and sort of the disparity of just health and improving equity. So my trainer, Don Patterson, he's an advocate for health equities. He's in the steering group and the working group for the health equities in the Royal College. And anyone interested, I definitely recommend checking out that working group through the Royal College website. And then I realised I have these skills. I'm using them in the local community, but I feel there's a wider world out there. And I was born in Sri Lanka. My family left Sri Lanka at the start of a civil war there, and then just I think global politics, and I've always had an interest in geopolitics, global health, etc. And then it spurred me on to do a master's in public health at the University of Sheffield. Did that part time over 2 years whilst working as a GP. And then I think that was potentially going to lead me to do the public health training program in the UK, but I did the global health module, and that solidified my career arc at that point, was to do more work in the global health sphere.
looking out for people who may want to sort of follow a similar journey to you or get involved in more humanitarian work. Do you feel that there's any specific requirements that people would have to have? So you mentioned you did a master's and you clearly had a passion for global health, but also that you'd worked in UK deprivation. Are there any specific requirements or experiences that you think are relevant for those hoping to get involved, particularly with your hat on now, thinking about your role in recruitment for CADUS now?
There are lots of requirements, and one of them is that, as I mentioned before, the ethics and morals of what you do. And there is a lot of work to do in the United Kingdom at the moment. So there are plenty of roles available working with asylum seekers in your local practice, in hotels, etc. There are so many different initiatives. And I would say if the first thing to look at is to see whether you can work at that level of deprivation, and we have significant deprivation in the United Kingdom. If you feel like you can and enjoy, in inverted commas, that work and you find it fulfilling, that's the point where I think you should look potentially, if you want to, then deploy abroad. Educating yourself, there are so many free resources online, such as disasterready.org, free online learning platform, loads of courses on humanitarian principles and basics of deploying to humanitarian settings. It's not medical, it's more sort of the I wouldn't say managerial, but it's looking at sort of the ethics, the why and how responses are deployed. And then just being ready. I think I was ready at the time. I'd been a general practitioner for about 2-3 years at that point. The foundation doctors, take my hats off to them. For coming out and doing the work that they do. And they were able to contribute for sure. But I think with how we are, I think I would wait before to complete your general practice training. And then I've got loads of later career GPs as well who are interested in this work. And I would definitely advise people to start reading and consuming knowledge through these online resources, as well as just reading. How you learn about sort of the work is also just consuming media as well, such as books about people who've done this or stories of people who've lived through crossing the Mediterranean, crossing the Channel, the swimmers on Netflix, etc. Many different documentaries and films out there where you can consume and see, because for me, It's really difficult. Until you get out there, you don't know if you're able to, and that's fine. But it will start hitting home when you start thinking about sort of watching the deprivation on these TVs, documentaries, films, etc. And that's sort of the starting point, is if you feel you can be there and take on this role and that burden.
And I think that's really important, and sort of advice to people to sort of caveat the enthusiasm that people might have for these kind of roles is to think, are you emotionally, physically, morally ready to work in these sort of scenarios? And I think that's a really helpful advice to think, well, could you work with the populations that you're going to be working with in the UK and with refugees and asylum seekers at home in your home environment first, to see as a sort of trial run for these sorts of working environments. Did you, when you first went out to work in Greece, it sounds like you were thrown somewhat in the deep end, you know, being one of the most senior clinicians or the most senior clinician in that scenario. Did you have any specific training, you know, delivered by the organisation you were working with, or that were very useful from the masters and other bits that you'd done, that you'd recommend others do before they go and work in that volunteering scenario?
The organisation back there, Medical Volunteers International, I still recommend them. They were small back then. I had great contact with the management and onboarding before I left. And then essentially it was the training that I got in the UK which took over. So I had supervised back then foundation doctors with debriefing, etc. And then being involved as a salary GP with some debriefing of the docs, the GPs in training, which stood me in good stead as well. And then just having that comfort level of knowing that I've done the job for about 3-ish years or so, and I have that background knowledge. We're always learning. Like, Pattern recognition is really important. It's what we do in general practice. It's how we do our normal day job. And so it comes down to sort of trial and error. So what I'm getting at is make sure you've got great grounding in general practice. You don't need to be working in general practice for 20 years, but at least be comfortable to know that you might be the only person who's seeing patients. Are you comfortable to manage that? Take on that risk and make sure you're doing the best you can for the patients and the beneficiaries as well. That's the key thing. It's about the moral compass going back is, do you think you're doing the best job that you can for people? Because you're likely that person is seeing you on their potentially their worst day of the life, and you have to be at your best possible at that point, whether you've done the reading before. And like I've said, there's free online resources. I would highly motivate people to look at your dream job. Go on LinkedIn, go online, look at job adverts, look at what your dream job is, and then see what you've got. There's a lot of stuff that you can do without paying thousands and thousands of pounds to do a course, a postgraduate degree, diploma, etc. Start working at the basics for free before you start delving into sort of paying money, getting yourself into debt. Honestly, think about it first if this is the thing for you. And again, I would start by just volunteering locally. If you're interested in global health, there are going to be sort of language shops where language exchanges for a lot of people who are refugees or asylum seekers in the country. Volunteer locally. There, go on the UK Gov website. There is a volunteering page and see what there is. Even if it's working in a kitchen or so, serving food to local refugees, asylum seekers, homeless people in the UK as well. Think about ways to give back to your local community where you practice first, and then see if it will take you wider into the world.
I was going to ask, actually, they're mentioning about language. I'm going to make a sweeping assumption that you may not have spoken fluent Greek before you went out to your first volunteering role. How did that pan out, and in other roles and locations you've worked in terms of not necessarily speaking the language of those that you were working with?
Yeah, so very lucky to have always worked with great cultural mediators and interpreters throughout my work. I think one of the key things here is if you ever deploy abroad is get a basic phrase book or something like that. Learn some phrases. So in the Greek refugee camp, so many phrases in various languages from across the world, because it was an area what may not have been the final destination for these people in transit, but you would have various dialects, various languages, people from all over the world there. And there's just something about saying hello in a language that's foreign to you, but it's native to someone else, which brings a lot of comfort, improves the communication with that patient immediately. And it's these simple things, it's those simple touches that we know as general practitioners. It's the intangibles of what we do, the simple looking at someone in the eyes, giving someone space with silence, all of the things that we learn in general practice, which actually we're, I think, by far suited than a lot of other healthcare professionals. And I should caveat that I was saying by primary healthcare. So that can be anyone in primary healthcare, our wonderful practice nurses, physios, etc.
You were obviously in very difficult circumstances, and initially very new circumstances to you, and very senior in the group that you were with. Did you have sort of support or subsequent support when you came back, or take you through what had happened and anything you were struggling with coming back from those scenarios?
Part of my role, as I see, as a mentor, so I'm on the RCGP mentoring platform. If anyone's interested, just search my name and hopefully it comes up. But what I talk to my mentees about and people that I deploy is we need to destigmatize mental health issues with regards to this. Like, I've seen untold physical and mental trauma throughout all my deployments. It has affected me greatly, it's affected me deeply. There are things that still trigger me. And how I deal with that is my normal stress coping mechanisms at home, but also utilizing the pre-deployment, post-deployment psychological debriefing, which a lot of big organizations have. And that's the thing, you have to be open to the fact that your mental health will be affected greatly with this. And that's fine. That is absolutely fine. And if it didn't, that's a bit of a concern. They will affect you somehow, and we can't tell you how much it will, but just acknowledging it the fact that it will, and then utilizing the help out there that is usually given by the bigger organizations such as UK Med, Caddis, the smaller ones, the ones that you volunteer with, the unpaid jobs, very unlikely. And that's why it's really important to have a great social network at home. Utilize the mental support that you have, such as the practitioner health program in the UK as well. But don't neglect that. Don't oversee it. That's one of the most important parts of the job, is how it affects your mental health, and not dismissing that. So it's to make sure also that you're in the right mental health space to deploy abroad is really important as well to think of.
Really salient advice there, and important for any sort of role that we may be out of your comfort zone, and the debriefing side of it as well, and acknowledging that. So on to the benefits for you, because clearly it's something you're extremely passionate about and enthusiastic, and you know, you're giving back and mentoring people in many different ways. But what do you see as the main benefits to you of the humanitarian and global health work that you're doing?
It's difficult. It's changed over time. So my values have changed over the last 5 years, of how I wanted to help people out there. And now it's changed with the managerial role, is trying to redefine how we deploy as an organization as well, to remove that colonial aspect of humanitarian aid, which has been there for years, and to work in local partnerships, which is really important to look at their what's called localization, handing back power to the national organizations that live and work in these conditions day in, day out, instead of me just coming in for 6 months or whatever and then going home back to my comforts. So for me, that's how, where I go, and what my moral values are taking me down there. And that's what brings me joy, is if I can change the mindset of the people I work with, the organization, which I'm very lucky, I do work for a good organization. That's my drive at the moment. And then obviously it's just having a set of skills, which I'm very privileged to have as a general practitioner in the UK. And then I was very lucky to be able to afford to do a master's in public health from the University of Sheffield, and taking these skills on, which I've learned, and being able to exchange and learn as well. I'm a learner as well, so I just love learning about how things are done in various countries, the healthcare, sort of the culture, the cooking. Picked up some great recipes as well, abroad as well. That's one thing that I really enjoy, just meeting people and just immersing myself in various cultures as well.
Sorry to be negative, but what are the major downsides for you
in the current global climate as well? And these are always going to be weighing hot heavy now. Withdrawal of the USAID funding. The German Foreign Office has cut its humanitarian budget significantly. And then these are the things that can overwhelm you or get you down, is sort of, you can't control everything out of the world. In the world, you can do what's best. You can work within your free foot world and make the changes that you can make to the best of your ability. And that's a big downside, is just global politics, the way we're moving, the rhetoric out there, which is very unpleasant, to say the least. I want to say more, but I can't realistically. But
no,
yeah,
no, fair
big
enough.
Downside.
I think it's a very important point though to make, that you know, you're in the coalface to an extreme version, and you know, it's one thing hearing about things on the news. It's quite different if you have firsthand experience of what those places are like, and may be able to identify with it in a very much more intimate manner. And that's, you know, in the current climate, but also going forwards. You've given lots of really helpful and salient advice and caveats for those hoping to pursue this sort of work. Is there anything else you would add to that? Places to signpost people to for advice or interest or networks or courses? Anything that you'd like to add? Obviously, you know, you've given a lot already, and we can share lots of links attached to the podcast for people to go and weigh and look at. But anything you'd like to add from that perspective?
Yeah, so the RCGP Health Equity Working Group is really important to look at. I definitely got the name wrong. I apologize to Don Patterson. And bringing back to Don Patterson, he was also one of the founders, alongside some great people, Alice Deasy, who set up Fair Health, which is a great online resource for anyone who wants to work in health inequalities, and the Deep End Groups. I would say just cold emailing a lot of people and anyone in the deep end networks, anyone from any of these health inequality, health equity issues. They're always going to be nice to reply back to you. Look locally. The UK government website is great, but your sort of the week, not monthly GP update groups as well. There's always going to be someone who's working in health inequalities and asking them. Disaster Ready is a fantastic online free resource, and there are so many others to look at. The RCGP mentoring platform. There are many other GPs out there do this work who are also probably mentors. I'm more than happy to be contacted on that platform and be asked questions about what I do and give any other advice as well.
Amazing. That's really generous of you with your time. It sounds like you're already doing a huge amount to support those enthusiastic to pursue this as an opportunity to diversify their GP career. So we always like to end on a highlight or best moment. You've shared some of yours already and the sort of evolution of your values and what it's given you working in this environment. But if I asked you to share your absolute highlight or best moment, what would you say is yours?
I think it would come from Gaza, August or September 2024. So the clinic, primary healthcare clinic I was managing, we were chosen as a site for the polio vaccines, and we vaccinated just under 1,200 children in 3.5 days. And our team lead at the time, an amazing, amazing person called deputy team lead at the time, amazing person called Jennifer Higgins. She had been to Gaza before, had worked in a circus group. She was able to make contact with the local circus group who came, and they basically came, did some performances, but it drew in a lot of children from the wider community who had already got vaccinated but wanted to come and sort of just watch and laugh. And I realized at that point I hadn't seen a child laugh or for about 4 weeks when I'd been in country. And that was, I still tear up and become emotional thinking of it, because that was probably one of the biggest highlights. It was just, we had the medical aspect, the clinical aspect, which is polio vaccines, but we worked in collaboration with other organizations, other parts of the team. My deputy team leader was able to organize this with a local partner, circus group, which was fantastic. And then just to see laughs and smiles, and probably the worst time those children may experience in their whole lives, which, yeah. And those are the small moments that will keep you going back to deploy in various countries. There's always one small moment that will make you live with you for the rest of your life, which this will.
Amazing. What a lovely note to end on, and such an interesting interview. Thank you so much for giving up your time. It's a real you've shown a real example of showcasing the kind of amazing careers that GPs can have, but also how valuable that GP skill set can be at home and abroad. It's really generous of you to say people can contact you, but we will share any links that you have to share. So thank you very much for giving up your time and for being so wise with your advice about ensuring that people are emotionally, morally, physically, mentally ready, but how fantastic working in these scenarios can be. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Sophie.
We hope that this careers podcast has motivated and inspired you to explore the variety of career options available as a GP. Speak to your appraiser, your local training program directors, or perhaps join our RCGP mentoring program for further support to diversify your career. Thanks for listening, and good luck.
The GP Plus Careers Podcast.